Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm while she's away on vacation. Since 1988, about 100,000 Americans have donated one of their kidneys to save someone else's life. Yet each year, more than 1,000 people die because not enough kidneys are available. In a new book, author Daniel Asa Rose tells of his adventures in China, helping his cousin search for a kidney. It's titled Larry's Kidney, and Daniel Asa Rose joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. We talked several years ago in your previous book, Hiding Places.
Right.
And Daniel is also editor of the literary magazine, The Reading Room. And you can join our conversation, as always, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook, send us a tweet. We want to know what you have to think on this subject. Who the heck is Larry?
Oh, Larry, Larry. Well, you know what? I'll give you the full subtitle because that'll set you up for this whole thing. It's Larry's Kidney being the true story of how I found myself in China with my black sheep cousin and his mail order bride, skirting the law to get him a transplant and save his life. So you can tell from that he is my black sheep cousin. And he admits to that. He's a black sheep cousin, if anybody ever was, on so many levels.
We all have him.
Oh, we all have him. He'll be instantly recognizable to everybody. We all went to Ivy League colleges. Larry dropped out of high school. We all have had happy families. Larry's kind of a loner. First of all, in appearance, he looks a little bit, I say in the book, like Larry Flint, the publisher of Screw Magazine, kind of like a your friendly family pornographer type. He's taken a route not often traveled, and certainly not traveled in our family. He's an adjunct professor of what I call haggling in some Catholic college down south. It's actually arbitration and negotiation, but I call it just a higher form of haggling. He's a kind of a failed inventor of ingenious get-poor-quick schemes, including wooden neckties. The idea being everyone needs one. It's actually ingenious. It's you can sponge the gravy stains off. Canine kippas, yarmulkes for dogs, things like this. In anyone else's hands, these inventions would have made him a multi-billionaire. But Larry is able to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat.
The other way around.
To snatch defeat from the jaws of victory time after
poverty
time.
Poverty from the jaws of prosperity.
Exactly.
And you'd been estranged from him for a long time, and this phone call comes out of the blue. I mean, what happened?
Well, we hadn't been talking in about 15 years, and I'm on family vacation with my wife and kids in Colorado. We're on a ski lift trying to juggle mountain bikes when my cell phone goes off, and it's Larry. And I say, whoa, my long-lost cousin Larry? And he goes, yes, I admit to that. And I say, my black sheep cousin Larry? And he goes, yes, that's also true, as long as you don't mean it in a negative way and are just saying it objectively. And I say, yeah, that's what I am. Why are you calling me? And he said, well, I'm dying. And I said,
That got your attention?
That got my attention. And he said, first of all, are you still mad at me? And I said, what, you mean for ratting me out to the FBI 15 years ago? For allegedly inflating my income on a mortgage application, which you advised me to do because you needed the commission? He said, yes, I regret that, Dan. I said, well, no, I'm not mad at you about that. If you're truly dying, I'm not mad about that. Tell me the story. And he said, well, where did I reach you? And I said, well, I'm with my family in Colorado. He said, yes, I heard you got remarried. I was meaning to call you. And I said, well, that's 14 years ago, Larry, but thank you. It's good to hear from you. What's the deal? And he said, well, I've been on dialysis for 2 years. They tell me I have to wait another 7 to 10 more years before I am a suitable candidate for a cadaver kidney. And I'll tell you frankly, Dan, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be an invalid in a chair. Dialysis has left me with no life, and I will kill myself unless you come with me to China and get a kidney. Sunday. And I said, that's like 4 days from now, Larry. And he says, I said, that gives us no time to plan this thing, Larry. He says, Dan, no offense, but I know you well enough to say you suck at planning. I suck at planning. The way to do this is to just go over there and wing it. You know as well as I do that most of the deals in the world happen because you happen to be there, standing there when the deal goes down. And we could plan this from now until 2040, and it wouldn't be as good as just hopping over there and seeing what we can scrounge up.
Well, why did you agree to go? I mean, did you have any ethical qualms? Obviously, skirting the law was a mild way of putting what you were doing.
Well, the original subtitle was Breaking the Law. And then Larry said, you know what, Dan? I'm not going to announce that I'm an international criminal on the cover of your book. Thank you very much. So we compromised on skirting the law. The Chinese do have a restriction. They passed it about 2.5 years ago, just before I got my golden invitation from Larry. They basically said, well, the Westerners have so many reservations about the way we do this, the hell with the West. They can't get any. So they prohibited Westerners from getting any organs. Until that point, China had been the largest dispenser of organs in the world, which doesn't mean the rest of the world can't go there. The hospital that we eventually ended up in was filled with people from Yemen and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Arab royalty and Arab starlets and stars, but no Westerners. We were the only Westerners in the hospital, and I think in the city, in this far-off city, which I, of course, can't identify. But yes, I started out from a position of great moral conflict. I'd heard the stories, religious dissidents maybe being put to death, school children. I mean, I'd heard all the horror stories.
Put to death to harvest their organs.
To harvest their organs. Kidneys, corneas, hearts, lungs, livers, all kinds of stories. So I was very conflicted about it. But
so why'd you go?
Well, that's kind of the central mystery of the book, Steve. Why do I do it? In the opening pages, he guilts me to start. He throws everything he can
at me. Well, he says I'm dying.
He says I'm dying, so I had to take that into consideration. My little cousin is dying. I'd been fond of him always I remembered him as this tubby little kid who used to run up the down escalators and repeat Clint Eastwood lines, make my day. He was a little toughy, and I was very fond of him. He had also – I owed him. I owed him, which he was quick to remind me about. When I graduated college and was going to be a writer, I had no idea of how I was going to support myself. And he said, well, come live with me in my little apartment in Boston, and you can rent out slum apartments for me, and I'll even let you steal my Valium.
So he gave you a job.
So he gave me a job, sort of my first job, sort of set me on the route to being a writer. So
and a drug dealer.
And a drug dealer. No, that was Larry. That was one of his subspecialties. In fact, when I went away from his apartment for a weekend, I came back and the door to my bedroom was broken open. And I went, what's this? Didn't understand it. Went out, got a paper, sat down at my real estate office desk. And there on the front page of the Boston paper was biggest bust in 2 years. Apparently, he'd taken the opportunity of my limited absence to stash his drugs underneath the mattress.
So you got 4 days. You leave on Sunday.
Yep, you leave on Sunday.
He paid for the ticket?
Oh, no.
No?
No, no, no. I paid my own way the whole time. I didn't want to be...
You were a sucker.
Maybe that should have been the title. Sucker. How I found myself in China with my black sheep. No. No, I really felt... let bygones be bygones, let the bad blood go, and do the right thing by him. And also, frankly, I didn't think it was going to work, but I felt I had to help and try. I thought it was an impossible mission. We'd get over there. We'd spend a week. We'd see it was impossible. Who's going to give us a pre-loved kidney in China when it's against the law and we don't know anybody? And it would show my cousin there was no way, and maybe it would shake him out of his inertia. He'd come back and say, okay, I will stay on the list.
So what did happen when you got there?
Well, imagine it's you, Steve. Do you know a lot of people in China with lightly used kidneys who want to give them away? We didn't either. We didn't know a soul.
Tough market.
Tough market. I had been there 25 years before, which is one of the reasons he chose me. It hadn't been a happy time when I'd been there 15 years before. I'd actually been thrown in a jail cell for 3 hours, which I was...
Everyone's still waiting for you.
Well, I vowed when I was in my jail cell, it was actually in Tibet, Chinese-controlled Tibet 25 years ago, I vowed that if I ever got out of that country, I would never, ever go back. So I was scared to go there and break the law. By the way, how it happened was we were drinking barley beer, my traveling companion and I, and we were quite happy on the barley beer, and we were walking down a dusty road, and we saw some Chinese soldiers, and we jovially went up to them and said, hey, you know the shortcut to the Dalai Lama?
Yeah.
You know what? A little tip in life, when you're in China, don't talk to the soldiers. I think the same is probably true in Iraq. Don't talk to the soldiers in foreign countries.
There's a long list. Turkey's not a good place.
Yeah, I don't think so. No, I saw that movie.
But so you got to China, and you had no real plan.
No plan at all.
So what did you do? How did you start making connections?
Okay, first I went over from my hotel to Larry's hotel, and I took a gander at my cousin. I hadn't seen him in 15 years. He used to be 280 pounds. He's down to 160.
Oh, he was already there.
He got in the night before. Yeah. I sort of think I should give him a hug, but he's not the physical type. And frankly, I was shocked at his appearance and how much he'd aged. So I wanted to keep our cooties very separate. We'd never been close. So I sort of looked at him and said, what's our game plan? And he said, you tell me, Dan, here we are. We talked about it for a while, and there was this cleaning lady in the room who was sort of scrubbing the toilet and scrubbing the sink, and we talked, and I said, well, he said, I want you to know how much I appreciate your coming here on your own dime, and I said, well, it's the least I could do. And he said, I want to level with you about everything too, and I said, well, you already did. You told me it was illegal. And he said, no, the other reason I'm coming is because I'm getting married, and I went. Oh, well, congratulations, Larry. That's fantastic. You're a lifelong confirmed bachelor. And who's the lucky lady? And she said, well, that's her over there, scrubbing the sink. That was his mail order bride. He'd been corresponding with her on email for 2 years. He'd fallen in love with her. And this was his agenda B for coming to China. Larry is tight with a buck. And he figured if he's going to shell out for a round trip ticket to China, he's not just going to get a kidney. He's going to get a twofer. One from column A and one from column B, as he put it.
Yeah. But you've decided that the best chance of making these connections, interestingly enough, was in the small Jewish community.
Well, that's what I finally hit upon, and certainly only by circumstance. I was trying to be discreet. I started calling journalists for American papers and affiliates, no dice. I started calling Chinese journalists, no dice. I was trying not to take a bullhorn and go into Tiananmen Square, trying very hard not to do that. Mm-hmm. I threw the net a little bit wider, though, and pretty soon I was just sort of asking waiters, and I was asking doormen, and
putting on the sandwich boards and walking through.
Yeah,
anybody got a kidney? Not a good strategy.
Not a good way to do it. So nothing was happening, and it looked like time was winding down, and we were going to maybe hop over to the Philippines.
And we're going to pause right there. And you got to stay tuned to find out exactly how this happened. Larry's Kidney, Danny Iasarosa is with me. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in for Diane. You can hear the rest of the story if you stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in today for Diane. And as promised, my guest is Daniel Iasarosa, his book, Larry's Kidney. And you can join our conversation. We got some lines open, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. You started asking around, ruled out the bullhorn in Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm. Sandwich board wasn't going to work. What did work?
Well, as I was saying, we gave it about a week. Nothing was happening. Larry was falling more and more in love with his mail-order bride, even though she wasn't the way she described herself. She wasn't 5 feet one. She was more like 6 feet one. She wasn't 110 pounds. She was more like – well, she was built like a linebacker. She was kind of attractive in a way, but she didn't speak a word of English, even though she had told Larry on email that she was fluent and she was an esteemed architecture professor in a Beijing university. None of these things actually came to be. She was perhaps a substitute electronics teacher in a rural high school way the hell out towards North Korea. So I said, Larry, doesn't this mean –
So this was two shysters meeting.
Shysters meeting each other. I said, but isn't this truth in advertising, Larry? This means you're not – he said, no, I very much appreciate the fact that she lied to me the way she did. It shows a native cunning that I appreciate. So he fell deeper in love with Mary.
Takes one to know one.
Absolutely. So they were kind of great for each other. Who was I to judge? We thought maybe we'd go to the Philippines with Mary and see if we could hustle up a pre-loved kidney there. However, the night before we were to leave, after 1 week of striking out in Beijing, I got an email from a guy at home Remember the story about the FBI turning me into the FBI? This was the federal prosecutor in Providence. I after the FBI laughed off. There's a lot of stories here, Steve.
Well, let's tell the one about the kidney.
Okay. I got an email from a friend of a friend who said, I just got back from the countryside. I can meet you in Beijing at the temple tonight. And I said, a temple for Jews in Beijing? He said, yeah, yeah, you'll love the chicken. So I went that night, and the friend of the friend wasn't there, and I started working in the room. I felt like Schindler, the beginning of Schindler's List, you know, making contact with all the bigwigs, except these were good guys. And they were very well positioned in the world. There was the head of Reuters and the head of universities and banks, and they were all expats, Jewish expats living in Beijing. So I'm sitting there during the service, and I'm thinking, you know what? What if I made an appeal right here and now? Please don't do that, Dan. Keep seated. Don't. And against my better instincts, I stood up in the middle of the service. And on page 110 or so is the little one paragraph speech that I made, throwing myself on the mercy of the Jewish community of Beijing, telling them that if anybody could connect me with a healthy kidney, it would be a mitzvah.
Right. A blessing.
A blessing. Dead silence in the temple. I sit back down. I turn purple with embarrassment, thinking, God, what did I grow up to become? Service ends. Everybody races away from me, as I thought was appropriate. How could I be such a boor to wreck the hospitality that they offered me? And I was sort of thinking I would liquefy myself and dribble down a drain somewhere and just disappear. A reporter came up from New York. He was kind of pretty, and she said, so how's your brother doing? And I said, well, he's not my brother. Everybody thought it was my brother because they couldn't imagine I would do this for a cousin. I said, he's my cousin, and he's dying. And I said, I'm sorry. Have I overstepped here? You know, wow. And she said, well, hey, chutzpah is a Jewish word.
That's along with mitzvah.
Along with mitzvah, right. That's the name of that chapter, actually. Chutzpah is a Jewish word. So I said, but didn't I alienate everybody in here? Look, they've all scurried away. She said, everybody's processing. Just give it time. We're all processing. And little by little, she was right. They started coming around, and they said, you know, I had an uncle who needed a liver and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And then a woman, an Australian lady in a leopard print scarf, sidled behind me, and she said, meet me at the chicken.
She did.
So we met, and she said—
General Chow.
No, it was good American chicken. It was braised, and it was great. Olives, caper berries. It was delicious chicken. He was right. She said, well, you're absolutely correct. It is illegal. You could be thrown in jail. You could be made a poster boy for medical tourism, and they don't have a sense of humor about it. But she said, if it were my cousin, this is what I would do. And she proceeded to tell me that there was a mystery surgeon out in the west of China somewhere in a little burg of 10 million, you know, that we've never heard of. And she said, if you can get there by tomorrow night, there is a chance that he still has access to healthy kidneys. They will be screened for AIDS. This is a very advanced hospital. And this is what I would do if I were you. We did it. Next night, we were there. We took a crazy cab ride for many, many, many hours, driving on the wrong side of the road, knocking off our rearview mirror because we cut in between two trucks that happened to be connected. The cab driver looked like he hadn't slept in about 48 hours. He was eating a chicken claw with the hair still on it. I mean, it was an unbelievable ride. Larry started telling me his life stories. And I started learning about my cousin on the way to this little town and hearing his life stories, things I had never realized, what a disadvantaged life he'd had and how he'd encountered sexual abuse and all kinds of stuff. And I started getting deeper into the mystery of why I'd wanted to do this for him. Kind of it was guilt, kind of he didn't have the advantages of the rest of the family, and I wanted to even the playing field a little bit. A lot of reasons. I started figuring him out, and I started figuring me out, and I started looking at China with new eyes.
And it worked? I mean, what happened when you got there?
Well, first of all, it was turning into a comedy, which is something I couldn't believe at all. You asked me during the break, when did I realize this was a book? That's the great question. When he initially approached me, I had just begun work on another book, which was set in New Mexico. So I was a little bit irritated at the idea that I'd have to be derailed from that project. But I thought, you know, Larry's a fascinating character. He's probably the most fascinating character I'll ever write about. So what the heck? And I'll probably get an article out of it anyway, at least about the changes in Beijing since I'd been there a quarter century before, or maybe something about Larry. Well, once we were in Beijing and we started encountering people, and Larry refused to eat the native cuisine, favoring instead the Girl Scout cookies that he had stashed in his suitcase. Even though he was diabetic, he was eating Caramel Delights. I started realizing, you know what? This is a life and death story. However, it's very, very, very funny. So I started taking notes, and over the next 2 months, I compiled 600 pages of notes. So we get to this little town, out this little burg of 10 million people, and we check into the hospital, and no one speaks English. And I sort of, through a lot of body English, I say, "So are we in time for dinner?" And she says, the sort of hospital coordinator says, "No dinner." And I said, "Okay, well, where are the vending machines, or where are the snacks?" She said, "No snacks." Turns out, no snacks, no pillows, no sheets, no food, no plates, no silverware, no towels, no soap, no toilet paper. Everybody brings their own. So out I went into the marketplace to try and forage for my cousin.
And including for the kidney, or the kidney was done in the
hospital. Well, the long process for the kidney. Well, we just put ourselves in their hands. It was a question of trust, just trust. And we said, "How long will it take? How long are we going to be here?" She said, "Oh, no, not appropriate time to talk about this." We said, "How much is it going to cost?" No, not appropriate at all. I said, "Well, at home it costs about $250,000, but insurance pays. Here, insurance is not going to pay. Can you give us a ballpark?" No. She said, "Just sit quietly, be clam. We give you clam pills to stay clam, and just sit tight and be good, and it will happen." Well, nothing happened. Week after week after week, we were just sitting there. And
For how long?
Well, eventually we got in to see Dr. X, the mystery surgeon. And Larry charmed the man, telling him about his inventions. One of his inventions was an 1-800 UFO call line. Dr. X was so pleased about this because he was a UFO buff, it turned out. He said he tells many stories about UFOs and hones his party skills. So he loved Larry, and there on the spot, he sort of agreed to get him a kidney as fast as possible.
And that was for how long?
Well, we ended up staying there for 2 months in this little city. And we both fell in love with China during these 2 months. When I'd been there a quarter century earlier and I'd been thrown in this jail cell by those harsh Chinese soldiers, I found China to be a scary place. It's a new generation now. And they are lovely, lovely people. And I was just wandering around for 2 months, visiting Larry in his dialysis unit and taking care of him. And then nothing but time on my hands. So just exploring the little city of China. And I fell in love.
And he eventually did get a kidney.
Oh, yeah. Got the kidney. Great kidney.
And how is he now?
Well, he's still depressionistic, as he puts it. He's a kind of depressed guy, but his kidney is doing wonderfully. He has, within 48 hours of getting the new kidney installed, he had pink cheeks again.
Wow.
He was smiling. It's a miracle organ. It really is. It cleans your blood. And he looked the way he did as a little kid again.
Well, this is a very amusing story to say it's a comedy, but of course, organ donors is a serious subject
very
as well.
Very serious.
And we're pleased to have with us on the phone Dr. Robert Montgomery. He's the chief transplant surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital and was recently involved in a countrywide process where eight different people received kidney transplants as part of a new program. And Dr. Montgomery, we're delighted to have you with us on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't know how much of the show you've been able to hear, but part of what drove Daniel Rose's cousin Larry to desperate measures to go to China and seek this illicit kidney was the difficulty of getting one legally in America. Talk about what the situation is for ordinary people who are in need of a kidney transplant.
Well, we certainly are in the midst of a crisis in organ availability in the United States and indeed in most countries around the world. There are about 80,000 or so folks who are waiting currently for a kidney transplant, and only about 20% of those individuals will receive a kidney this year. So if you do the math, it takes about 5 years now of waiting before you're likely to get a kidney.
And what is causing this deficit? Just the lack of organ donors?
Well, despite all of the public education and the money that's been spent over the last decade to increase awareness about donation after death, we really have not seen much in the way of gains in the number of people who choose to donate their organs after they've died. At the same time, there's been almost an exponential growth in the number of people who need a kidney transplant, whose kidneys have failed. And there are many reasons for that, but probably the most significant is that the diseases that cause renal failure are on a rise. And the two most important diseases are hypertension and diabetes. And you know, obviously obesity can contribute to either of those diseases. So we have a lot more people waiting, and about the same number of deceased donor organs, only a slight increase. Now, the one bright spot in this story is that we have seen a very significant increase over the past decade in the number of people who are willing to donate a kidney to a loved one while they're living. So live donation has recently surpassed deceased donation in many parts of the country in terms of the, you know, the source of the organ.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Montgomery, when you mentioned live donations, you were part of the team that did this very noteworthy procedure or set of procedures just in the last month or two. Describe for our listeners exactly what you were involved in with this domino transplant.
Yeah, so we performed a series of eight transplants at four different transplant centers throughout the country. And people, eight people received a kidney from a stranger, and their loved one, who had wanted to give them a kidney but couldn't because they were incompatible, gave a kidney to someone else. So it set off this sort of chain reaction. And, you know, this is a significant problem. About a third of the individuals who want to give a kidney to their loved one are unable to do so because of either a blood or tissue incompatibility. And so in the past, we've just, you know, told those folks to go home, and their loved one who's in need of a kidney had to wait like everyone else. But we have several different ways now that we can get around that. So this is another bright spot that's, you know, here now.
But I gather in this situation, one of the keys was to utilize a national database that was able to locate. You had these donors who couldn't give to their loved ones, but you found someone around the country who was compatible, and this is how the chain worked.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And this is one of the solutions to closing this gap between organ supply and demand.
Now, one of our listeners writes in and asks, if you are a healthy person and you donate a kidney, does that impact your quality of life at all, or can you function pretty normally?
You can function very normally. We do a very thorough evaluation of the donors, and if you pass that evaluation process, that means that we believe that you will not be adversely affected in any way by donating a kidney. And we know that people who donate kidneys have the same life expectancy and the same risk of you know, ending up on dialysis themselves as the general population.
Now, let me ask you one other thing. I know you have to get back to surgery. And that is, you heard some of Daniel Rose's story. His cousin goes to China because he was facing 5 years. You made that point, could be 5 to 7 years, that he his quality of life had been badly degraded by his experience on dialysis. And you can understand better than us the desperation, I'm sure, that some people feel. What's your reaction to this phenomenon of medical tourism where people go abroad engaging in, as Daniel has admitted, in somewhat shady practices to procure an organ. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm not too happy about it. You know, I think that there's a very significant risk of vulnerable populations being, you know, adversely affected by this type of practice.
Meaning what?
I believe that donation should be a voluntary decision, and that, you know, individuals shouldn't be pressured into the decision for monetary gains. Now, you know, there is sort of a spectrum between what you are discussing today and a completely voluntary system, and that would be, you know, somewhere in the middle, giving some incentives to people to donate, paying their expenses,
yes,
their travel expenses, for deceased donation, paying for funeral costs and that sort of thing. I'm in favor of that, but not an outright market for buying organs. I think we haven't fully utilized the potential for the system as it exists right now.
I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're about to leave. Dr. Robert Montgomery, Chief Transplant Surgeon at Johns Hopkins, thanks so much for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Robin and Murray Sinclair, helping sustain NPR's coverage of the global economy, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org, and by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, did the Bush administration discourage an investigation into a mass grave of Taliban prisoners who had surrendered to our allies, the Northern Alliance, in 2001? We talk with three members of Physicians for Human Rights, the doctor who discovered the grave, the doctor who performed an autopsy, and the researcher investigating the story. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and my guest this hour, Daniel Asa Rose, his book, Larry's Kidney, being the true story of how I found myself in China with my black sheep cousin and his mail-order bride, skirting the law, formerly breaking the law, to get him a transplant and saved his life. And Daniel Rose, we have a lot of folks who want to join this conversation, and here's a question which follows the Dr. Montgomery's comments. As amusingly told as this story was, writes our listener, I'm appalled. It is a perfect example of some of what's wrong with this country. If it's good for me, hang the consequences. Who cares what the source was as long as the cousin got his kidney?
Yep, I'm familiar. That's sort of the way, that was my initial reaction too. But when you get into it a little bit more, you become less dogmatic and you see that it's not quite as black and white as the caller and the good doctor suggested. There are many shades of gray. I was asleep to the problem. I didn't know how bad renal disease was. I didn't know about the shortage of organs until Larry called me. And now I am just on the side of the Larrys of the world who are being told by their good doctors to sit tight for 5 to 7 to 10 years, and maybe you'll get a kidney and maybe you won't. What are these poor people to do? You know, I come from a medical family. My dad, my brother, all my aunts, my cousins, everybody is a doctor. They were pretty squeamish about it, too, in the beginning. And they reflected the conservative medical establishment in this. They said, you don't know where it's coming from. You don't know how hygienic the conditions are. You don't know anything. It's true. I didn't know anything. But Larry was desperate. He could not stay here any longer and wait. So we had to take matters into our own hands.
Did you learn the origin of the kidney?
Yes, we did.
And do you know whether it was paid for?
I do know indeed.
And tell us.
Well, first of all, I want to just say that Larry's doctor said a very telling thing. He was discouraging him from going. When Larry said, "I'm going," the doctor said, "Good for you."
Hmm.
Yep. Because he knew how desperate the situation was. Well, we got over there and we did have our interview with the mysterious Dr. X, the surgeon, and I was very concerned. I wanted to push him without alienating him, because after all, we were in his hands and he had Larry's life at stake. But I did want to know, and I said, we hear terrible horror stories in the States about Falun Gong and school children and prisoners. Where does this kidney come from? Now, the Chinese don't show their emotions very readily. You know, the most they'll do is sort of present a blank face if they're angry. This man turned red with anger, and he said, this was a prisoner. I do all the paperwork. I know about this prisoner. He's bad, bad man, bad, bad man. Apparently, he was in jail. He was a youngish man who had made a home invasion, gone in to rob this house, killed the grandfather, left, decided he didn't want to leave any eyewitnesses, so went back and killed the daughter and the grandbaby. Again, the doctor said, bad, bad criminal. I would kill him 100 times. To his way of looking at it, something good was coming out of this prisoner. Now, the reason it took 2 months after the donor was selected was because they had to go through the courts. They had to get all the letters of...
Did they harvest one of his kidneys, or was he executed?
He was executed.
He was executed.
Yep. We didn't know. After all the papers were signed, which took 2 months, he had to sign. Of course, I don't know what sort of pressure was put on him, but I do know that this surgeon is a world-class surgeon. On the caliber of Dr. Montgomery, he travels all over the world and lectures to people about kidney transplants and teaches people in the West how to perform kidney transplants. He does more kidney transplants than any American doctor because they've had an opportunity to practice it more in China. And this man, who was a good and dignified and decent human being, assured me that what I'd been told in the West was not true, and that the man who was going to be executed was ready to be executed and was prepared to sign on the dotted line. And the conditions were hygienic. We were very impressed. The whole time we were so impressed. We didn't know when we started out what the conditions would be like. We were not pleased when we discovered there were no... but it was at least as hygienic as any American hospital. The doctors were better.
Let me read this email from Barbara in Epsom, New Hampshire. I donated a kidney over 4 years ago with laparoscopic surgery, minimally invasive, done with small holes, tiny slit. The procedure was virtually pain-free, and I gave my sibling his life back. From exhaustion and nausea, he is now vigorous and active. Mm-hmm. We need a kidney now for another sibling, but none of us matches. The College of Transplant Surgeons has suggested payment should be available for donors. Thank you for spreading the word on the need.
Yeah. There are so many things we could do in this country to open the floodgates for donors. We could reward donors, not necessarily with cash. We could give them health insurance, the sort of health insurance program that our congresspeople have. We could give them all sorts of tax incentives, all kinds of things. We could at least reward them for their travel and their expenses and stuff like that. We don't do any of that. We could also reverse the donation default, as they have in some countries, in Belgium and Norway, and most impressively in Spain, so that unless you specifically opt out, your organs are considered available for transplant. That has opened the floodgates for organs in those other countries.
Now, one of the things that Barbara's email highlights, though, is that as I'm reading the literature, that using a organ from a live donor is
preferable
yes. to a cadaver. Yes. And her point that... And as Dr. Montgomery said, that you can do this and still live a full
yes.
and rich life afterwards
yes.
should be encouraging to people who are contemplating that decision.
It's so true. It's so easy to donate. First of all, every call, every listener should go to donatelife.net, and it takes about a minute and a half, and then should educate him or herself about how safe it is. We have we've been poorly educated about how easy it is. People have all sorts of myths and fears about what will happen to them if they decide to transplant, if they decide to donate. I've had people ask me, well, will they remove my organ maybe before I'm quite dead, or will they not take as good care of me because they want to get my organs? None of that is true. It just needs education. We need to take the initiative in this country.
Now, we have another email. Charlotte writes to us from Alexandria, Virginia, and I'm sure others have a similar question to Charlotte's, since you say you were away for 2 months. Mm. I was wondering what Mr. Rose's wife and family thought about all of his overseas adventures. It must have been a lot for them to put up with, him being away for months, spending a lot of money, pouring a lot of emotional and financial resources into his notoriously undependable and unpredictable cousin.
It's true, and my wife had never met Larry, had only heard the family stories about this black sheep guy, and so she was not initially very happy about it. However, she knew I needed to do this, and she backed me up, and I call her incomparable in the book. She's an incomparable lady. Also, we didn't think it was going to take that long. We really thought a week in China, maybe go to the Philippines, prove it's not possible, come on back. I had no idea it was going to be 2 months. We separated in Colorado to do this trip. I kissed the boys goodbye, expected to see them in a couple of weeks at the outside. Well, it was 2 months. We had beautiful conversations, which I have transcribed into the book verbatim. Two lively boys were, wondering when I was going to come home and be with them. They took care of the ducks at home while I was off in China doing this. And I really had no idea how long it was going to take. But I couldn't, once we were ensconced in this hospital, I couldn't very well leave them. So I was determined to ride it out.
Let's talk to some of our callers, Daniel. And we have Amanda in San Antonio. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. Thank you for having me. What I wanted to say was I had a kidney transplant 2 months ago, and I had been waiting for 2 years as well. I was on dialysis, and I had a six-way swap, a live donor as well, and it's not hopeless. I had over 25 people volunteer to give me a kidney. That they weren't a match. Eventually, a friend insisted on being the person, and it's not hopeless, and that it can be done. And it's just difficult. And I also did consider going to China. I considered going to Pakistan. I considered the Philippines. But it all worked out. So for people not to give up hope.
Thanks so much for your call.
Congratulations, Amanda.
Do you find that, do you hear stories like that, that people like Amanda?
Yeah, I hear her very hopeful stories, people who have reached out to loved ones and perfect strangers coming forward to help. I said I fell in love with China because of how generous everybody was and how they put themselves on the line to help us. But Americans, too, are capable of that. I think that's why I felt so at home there. There was a lot of similarities between the hospitality of the Chinese people and the hospitality of the American people. And I think once Americans become educated to this issue and become less fearful about the consequences to their own personal states of health, they will open their hearts and start donating more.
Let's talk to Rachel in Elkhart, Indiana. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Rachel.
Hi. Thank you so much. I have questions. We have a friend, a very good family friend, a wonderful woman, and she has been on the list for like 7 years now, and nothing is happening, and it just seems like she's waiting, and we've all tried to figure out ways to, all her kids have been tested, and they can't afford to go to China. What do you say for people like that?
Is she a suitable candidate?
She is. She is. It's just that she has not, she's been on the list. And then, celebrities will get, ahead of. I mean, George Lopez had a kidney transplant and was immediately given a kidney.
Yeah, we're not sure about celebrities jumping the list. We're not sure if they really get preferential treatment or not. We think not. We're a very equitable. We have equitable ideals in this country, so we're offended by that. But, she's on 7 years. She sounds like she's in a situation the one that Larry found himself on. Larry was not a very viable candidate. He was a couch potato. Yes, he was a gun-toting couch potato, but he was a couch potato. And he was a diabetic, and he kept eating these Girl Scout cookies. So the doctors said, you're not at the top of our list. This is your aunt, you say, who's been waiting for 7 years?
Close family friend.
Oh, close family friend. Is she in?
Active. Mm-hmm. She's very, healthy and everything, except for the kidney. And she always keeps a big smile on her face. Mm. But it's so hard. Mm-hmm. Her son goes to college. We're good friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he has to go home. He's like, you know, mom's sick. And mm-hmm. it hurts me to know that. And
sure.
I, you know, we've all offered to try and be a match, and their youngest son right now is going to get tested. And it's just, it's very hard, and they don't have the finance or the ability to get over to China and do something like you did, which I am very thankful that your cousin was able to do that. But mm-hmm. it's just very hard to watch somebody so positive and so mm-hmm. worthwhile not be able to get a kidney.
Thanks so much for your call, Rachel. We appreciate it. Larry, Daniel, there are a number of emailers who asked a similar question. Did you personally offer to donate a kidney?
Great question. I did not. And this proves how unheroic I am. Some people have tried to make me out to be something I'm not in doing this. I'm not at all. I'm just Larry's cousin. And honestly, it didn't even occur to me until Mary, of all people, attacked me.
The mail order bride.
The mail order bride attacked me about 6 weeks in. And she said, you are having a good time in China. You come off as a big hero. You don't even donate your kidney. I said, whoa, my kidney? And she goes, of course. Of course, you give your kidney. Well, that's how unheroic I am. No, I was willing to do this, but it's not in our ordinary thinking as people who walk around to think we should give our organs. I was not awake to this, even going over there.
Are you now?
I'm a donor of everything. Absolutely.
So it changed you?
Yeah, it totally changed me. And I'm changing my friends. I'm saying there's no reason why we should not donate. We can even think about it narcissistically if we like. We can say, look, just because we die, do our organs have to die with us? Give them a second chance at life. Donate your organs. Get a little shot at immortality. There are lots of ways of looking at it. I agree with Rachel. There have got to be more creative ways of tackling the problem. And that's why I wrote a comedy about this very serious issue, because I wanted to stop thinking in the box. I wanted to get people to start thinking outside the box, coming up with all kinds of other ways of looking at the problem.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk, Daniel, to it. We've got a couple of more callers. Stephanie in Detroit, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I have to say I've been really emotional listening to this. My son is 9 years old and was diagnosed with end-stage renal failure last summer. And just maybe 2 weeks ago, my husband, after a year of going through the process, was ruled out as a donor. We're a military family. I just lost my job. We're not in a position, even if I were so inclined, to violate every law, moral, and ethical code I have to mm-hmm. go to China and buy a kidney. Mm-hmm. And I really find it, frankly, repulsive that this is being put forth as such like a lighthearted comedy of errors sort of travelogue, that your guest seems to have so many good ideas and so many insights into how to increase organ donor awareness. But for his family and for his cousin, those rules don't apply. Everybody else should pursue living donation. Everybody else should do this. Everybody else should do that. But hey, we can skip the line. We can go buy an organ. And as somebody whose child is waiting, I find that disgusting. And it really, really upsets me.
Thank you for your call.
I am so sorry for this, Stephanie. I hear your pain. It's terrible. I just suggest you scour the bushes. You beat the bushes. You find every creative way you can. We found a creative way of doing it. You need to, until there are enough organs in this country, until legislators reverse the donation default, until we educate the public to give organs more freely, everybody has to be creative about it. We can be lighthearted. We can be tragic, however we want to do it. But the point is, everybody has to take charge of their medical destiny. Get a website and put your story out there.
But part of what she is saying is that people who have certain financial resources, mm-hmm. people who have certain skills, mm-hmm. as a writer, as a haggler, as you pointed
sure.
out, can go to China and do mm-hmm. this. And what do you say to someone who says, you're skipping the line and somehow we can't do that?
Yeah. Well, I wrote an op-ed for The Times a couple of weeks ago about all the moral outrage that's been directed at Steve Jobs, whom they've accused of skipping the line. And I say, you know what? We're misplacing our moral outrage. It shouldn't be towards the Steves of the world, or may I say the Larrys of the world. It should be toward the American system, which impoverishes the supply. Let's open the floodgates. With a few simple changes, we can absolutely flood the market with organs. Now, Stephanie and her dear 9-year-old son. Stephanie, it doesn't take much to open up a website. You know, get some help if you don't know how to do it yourself. But make a website, put it out there. Thousands of people will see it. Put your story out there. I mean, I choked up when I heard your story. Readers will choke up when they hear it. When they learn about your little boy, they'll want to help. Find ways of going around the system, because the system right now is restrictive and punitive.
And one of the – we only have about a minute left, but one of the things that Dr. Montgomery's experiments and more than experiments, his new procedures are showing is that if – she pointed out that her husband, after a year, turns out not to be a match. Mm-hmm. It must be a heartbreaking experience. But what this new system allows is to, in effect, a trade. He could trade his kidney to someone somewhere else where he was compatible and get a kidney back for his child. And this seems to be a very promising dimension.
Yeah, there are lots of promising new ways. There are organizations whereby if you sign up to be a donor, you'll be a more available for a donation sooner than if you hadn't decided to be a donor. There are all kinds of new ways of thinking about it. But the point is, don't blame people for skipping around. Don't blame the creative uses of the system. We all have to start thinking out of the box. We all have to find ways to lick this problem, and we can do it.
That's Daniel Asa Rose. His new book is Larry's Kidney, and also soon to be a movie. I nominate Ben Stiller to play you, but you want someone handsomer. Delighted.
Hey,
to have
Ben's
you.
Very handsome.
Delighted to have you with us, Daniel Rose.
Thank you, Steve.
As I say, his book is Larry's Kidney. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and thanks so much for spending your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.